Welcome to the Nine Be Praised. I'm Jack.
And I'm Joe.
And we're it's a time-honored, I say time-honored, it's a tradition on this on this show where, you know, we start off by promising one thing and then we end up giving you something else. So for the handful of people who came here expecting Probe, the Zero, I got this. The Zero Initiative, right?
Imperative.
Oh no.
He's been calling it the Zero dot 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 all day.
Yeah, the Zero Room.
Not only is the guest that is going to appear on that episode unavailable this week, but due to a few technical difficulties, Jack in fact could not watch the Zero Imperative. So we'll be back, baby, with that one.
And yeah.
Instead, in our quickest turnaround from choosing a subject to actually recording about it, i.e. Jack has just watched it before we press record. Jack, what are we going to be talking about today?
Well, you know, in another time-honored tradition of this show, I'm going to stall for time. Because I feel like the story of how we ended up here is quite extraordinary.
This is the ultimate example of the best laid plans of mice and men going hideously wrong.
Because Joe had sent me late yesterday, a copy of Probe. Had sent me a copy of the Probe episode. That sounds weird. That sounds worse.
Horny, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Maybe not.
I'm not sending you any porn, all right?
Joe, I tried to open it. I don't want to talk about this. It's a bit inappropriate.
But you couldn't access it, could you?
No, my Dropbox was completely full, so I either had to spend money and expand my Dropbox to make room for Probe the Zero Dawn. Or I could go through my personal files and delete things to make room for it.
Another example where I could open a Zoom call, put my copy on, share the screen, and then I'll go off down the shops and you watch the thing.
Oh, so wait, just to be clear, were you gonna play it through your computer or were you gonna put it on? Oh, okay, because I took that to mean you were going to put it on your TV in a room and just turn my computer.
Put it on the computer so you could actually watch it properly on your computer.
Oh, I see. I was just, because I thought you meant I would just be, because you said I've got to pop out to the shops for 10 minutes. So I thought I was just going to be sitting facing a TV screen in an empty room on the other side of the world, watching Probe the Zero Rising.
This is the only way to watch a Bill Banks production, I'll tell you.
and then it was around this point when Joe pitched this to me, which was about an hour before we were going to record. I did, as Joe was leaving, I think you were leaving for the shops, Joe, I say, we've got a guest for this one, don't we? And you go, no, he can't actually make it.
So you were like, I can't watch it. The guest's not appearing. Should we talk about something else?
Yeah, I was just like, should I just quickly put on something I can actually just watch on my TV?
Do you know, this is something I very rarely do nowadays, because I do a lot of podcasting. So the Doctor Who I usually watch is prep for a podcast. But I'm off this week, and I just thought, you know what? I just want to watch a Doctor Who episode for pure pleasure. That's it. Just to enjoy it. And I was like, well, what do I really love? What's going to really cheer me up? You know, I know. The nuclear apocalypse of Turn Left. No, which I love. But I just watched that just for fun. And then I thought, well, there you go. I'll throw that one at you.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't watched Turn Left in quite a while, I think. So I was like, oh, yeah, Turn Left. One of the, it's a rip-roaring adventure. I watched it. I got very sad and just kept getting sadder, and then finished, and then went, oh God, I've immediately got to record this, as opposed to digesting all my thoughts on this.
There's a lot in there, isn't there? There's an awful lot in this one.
Oh, it's packed to the gills. I mean, I had so many are we doing this? Are we
let's
just talking about the
Come on, let's do it.
But I should say, Will, who did we have lined up to be our guest for pro?
The fabulous Dylan Rees.
Yeah, who will make it onto the podcast some other time.
Yes, and check out his podcast, Too Hot for TV, should you like any spin-off or Wilderness Years Doctor Who.
Oh, that was a good plug then.
Thank you. You're very good at this now. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, with Turn Left, since we're doing that now at such short notice, I think even by our standards, that was a quick turnaround.
Usually it's like a day. We'll do the day before and say, Dashie, do you fancy talking about this? Oh, okay, I can squeeze that in 24 hours, not an hour.
I made myself a cup of tea, two pieces of toast. I had a great time. But yeah, with the Turn Left, it's really interesting to... And you know, this is in the meta text, I guess. This is separate from the episode itself. It's really interesting to consider it now, after years and years.
Yeah,
I think because they're both very different. You know, one's an episode of Doctor Who, one's a whole show, and they're very, very different in some very key senses. But the germ of the idea for years and years is kind of in this show, in this episode. So it's quite something to, on the one hand, be like, God, this is bleak. God, this is just, you know, so, so achingly sad in places.
For Doctor Who, this is about as far, I think, as you can take it.
I mean, yeah. You
know, it's something other. And I think, you know, remember we talked about the New Adventures in the past? I think they've gone beyond this level of bleak. And it just, it's not Doctor Who anymore.
Yeah. But this is precisely the thing. You know, there's one voice in my head going, there are two wolves in me. There's one that's going, what? God, this is, there. God, there's, this is very upsetting and miserable. And then the other, there's another one that's going, well, you know what? This is actually quite hopeful from Russell T. Davis. This is, look at this. This is packed to the gills with optimism compared with years and years. It kind of reminds me, what you just said there, reminds me of, and I think we've talked about this before, your relationship with Russell T. Davis's first Doctor Who, proper Doctor Who story, which was Damaged Goods. Because I remember you said you liked the... Well, you liked the book up to a point in that it was a good novel, but a bad Doctor Who story because it was so bleak and miserable.
Yeah, it's shockingly mature, that one. It features, you know, men giving men blowjobs and drug taking, and it leans into like abortion. And it's just a lot of very sort of, you know, 18 rated material in a Doctor Who story, and like that's not for a family audience, is it? I would not give Damaged Goods to an 8-year-old and say, read this. This is a rollicking adventure.
But when they did the audio adaptation, which was adapted by Jonathan Morris, but very much with Russell's blessing and with a few notes from him, from what I understand, you quite liked.
I did. They deliberately said they toned down the excesses of the adult material and they kind of gave it a bit more of an adventure rather than just for a fucking miserable time. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, Damaged Goods, the prose of Damaged Goods is excellent. It is a terrific book. Mind you, I wonder, you know, if you could have a novel of Turn Left, which is sort of years and years style bleakness in there.
Well, it's kind of interesting to, as you might imagine, it's been a while since I've watched Years and Years, because it just absolutely floored me the first time I watched it. And it's brilliant, but it's not something, you know, you can just put on casually. You know, it's not like it's The Unicorn and the Wasp.
No.
But my memory of it, the one of the key differences that occurred to me is that in Turn Left, so much of that story is centered around the about ordinary people, in this case Donna, and how their choices change the world, and how ordinary people can change history, how entire worlds are built around simple choices made by an ordinary person like Donna Noble. Whereas Years and Years follows an ordinary family, but it's much more of a story of them being swept up in events well beyond their control. And
there's a lot of that here as well, because Donna's family are along for the ride, aren't they?
Yes, that is true. And I guess the other side of that is Donna isn't, but there is that. Because I think Donna mentions that right at the end when she's, you know, facing the Cronon mirrors or whatever they are. And she says, "Oh, I'm not special. It's this thing that's making on my back that's making me special."
Yeah. We've got to talk about this. Her performance in that scene.
Oh God, it's so arresting and so hard to watch.
So raw. I can't. Can I put my hands on the table and just say I think this is, without exception, the best companion performance ever in Doctor Who? I don't think it's been bested. I think companions have given bloody good performances before and afterwards, but I don't think a gift of an episode has been handed to an actress like this, who, you know, the audience, a large portion of the audience, sort of underestimated going into this series, and then who floored so many people with how she delivered in this particular episode.
Yeah. I mean, given the amount of things Catherine Tate is asked to do in this story, it almost feels strange to call it a gift. It's a gift to, because I mean, aside from how dark the story is, there are so many things she has to pull off in her performance in this one. So the challenge of it is enormous, but it is I think the finished product of what they were doing, because I had a quick reread of some of the production details. I think Russell was really behind on this script. This one came fairly late in the production.
It's so tight, this script.
I don't think it was quite the rush job that Midnight was,
right.
But I think it took a little longer to write because Russell was late on another script, as he tends to be, and then had a lot of difficult he had some challenges getting the structure of it in place, and I think the I beginning
all of that continuity that's in there, that must have been to fit that together as a jigsaw, as a series of events that builds to that sort of momentum of disaster.
So the construction of it, so it, as is the case with anything in television, it all comes together quite rapidly, and as do the performances. But what you get is absolutely, I don't dispute that it's one of the great performances from one of the leads in Doctor Who. Absolutely, it's astonishingly good.
Yeah, and she's asked to, like you say, she's asked to deliver comedy, isn't she? Anne Marie, that's all I'm saying. Anne Marie.
Oh, I laughed at that.
Like she's asked to sort of be hysterical. Which she does brilliantly. She's asked to be afraid. That bit where, you know, she's got the bug on her back, and she's got like saliva. She's so scared, and tears in her eyes. I'm utterly convinced by that. She's asked to sort of deliver that hopeful speech before she goes back in time.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. Well, you're an actor. What's more of a challenge? Is it the sort of the raw emotion or the comedy?
Well, you say I'm an actor. I'm definitely not as good as Catherine Tate.
I beg to differ.
It really does depend. Because comedy, you know, everybody tells you comedy is hard, and comedy is hard. The challenge in something, I think the challenge in something, what I always, you know, there's a part of me that always thinks about how anytime Catherine Tate, whenever she's interviewed about Doctor Who, or she appears on a talk show and people go like, do the thing where they're like, in episode 12, when you did this, or they're like, do you know who Davros is? Yeah. And she'll be like, I have no idea. I don't know what any of this means. It's, and you watch her performance, like, how is this someone who doesn't know
I think a lot of that is a bit of an act, you know, just to be as she can be.
For sure. But in answering your question, I think in Doctor Who, part of me thinks that maybe the drama is maybe a little harder to nail, because, you know, I think kind of the advantage with Doctor Who in comedy is that, you know, and I could be wrong, and I'm very happy to be refuted. I mean, when you've already got so many strange looking monsters, and such odd sounding words and dialogue, sometimes you don't even need to do that much heavy lifting in the comedy, because everything around you in the show, it kind of can lend itself to comedy at a moment's notice. However, with drama, and it's what, you know, it's the thing we always say about Russell that he does so well, is that he makes something set in a strange fantasy world feel grounded and real and understandable in very human terms, even though, you know, you've got Rose Tyler shouting about chronon particles or something, and it still somehow means something. But, and they're talking about, like, you know, the Trickster's Brigade and time beetles or whatever. And it's all, for an actor, that's all just nonsense.
I think it's more explicit than most, because, you know, the premise is what happens to the Earth if the Doctor is killed.
Yes.
And that image of his hand falling out of that shroud and the screwdriver falling to the ground in slow motion, that is a potent image, isn't it? Like, and you can only do it once, really. You can only do it in an alternative universe story. But then by taking the Doctor out of the show, then it just becomes this very grounded... It's like a series... The events are absurd. So the Titanic hitting Buckingham Palace and everyone in America turning to fat and all of this. That's all the sort of stuff that's happening on the periphery that's making the situation so bad. But we are just... It's centred in sort of like a home with real people, with Sylvia, with Wilf, with Donna, with the families that they're living with. You know, it's brought down to such an intimate level. I don't think you can really tell a story like this too often either.
No, definitely not. And I think one of the really great things about the premise and the way it's executed here. I mean, I might talk in a little bit about how unique it is that Doctor Who could kind of do this premise in this way at this time. I don't think it could really do that at another time.
Go on.
Maybe the unit years, but that's about it. I think you can see where I'm going with that.
Well, you need a series of alien invasions that we've had to have happened, like, in all...
Yes.
For this plot sense. And, you know, he's done that, hasn't he? He's done one threat to the Earth after another, and we keep going back to the same characters. So it's the continuity of the show. It's weirdly linear, isn't it? Even though...
That's right. So there's that whole aspect to it. But one of the things I think that makes that's kind of great about this escalating series of disasters, it is that Russell... I mean, he chooses some of the darker ones, more serious-minded invasions, like, you know, the Smith and Jones with the hospital being beamed up and down and everybody's dead, or the Sontaran invasion from series four.
Yeah.
But I love that he doesn't shy away from the silly ones.
That's my the bit where they go, we're gonna get aid from America. God bless America.
Oh and yeah. And then hard cut to
the fat has started walking.
yeah. I mean, I think one of the best one for me is when it's so, because it's so potently strange as well, is when the Titanic comes down on Buckingham Palace and wipes out London. Because that, you know, in Voyage of the Damned, that is, you know, it's a completely different kind of story. That's like a disaster movie, but it's big and jolly and it's a Christmas special. And
that's the joke at the end of it, isn't it? It's like, oh, well, of course, it would be going there. And she's there, thank you, Doctor. It's all comedy, isn't it?
Yeah. And literally, it's what makes it so good is that the people watching it, watching the live broadcast on the BBC, they can't believe it either. Like, Donna literally says, that's not the is that a sequel?
Yeah.
She says, is that a sequel? And then they walk outside and they're all just looking at this mushroom cloud several miles away.
I can't imagine Doctor Who getting darker than that. That's London.
Yeah.
It's just a bomb site.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, Sylvia and Wilf and Donna, and they can barely process in that moment that
you know the bit that got me was when Sylvia goes, oh, I've just remembered so and so. Every now and again, I remember somebody else that would have been there. And Russell T. Davies is so good at finding those in such a massive concept, that sort of emotional beat that's going to really hit you right here.
Mm. Mm. I think it's really worth, and I know I don't need to do much prompting for you on this one. I think it's really important to state just how good Jacqueline King is in this episode.
Jacqueline King and Bernard Cribbins. I just absolutely believe them as a family, for one. There's enough sort of rolling the eyes and shouting at each other for me to go, yep, that's a real family, all right. But they adore each other. And Jesus, Jack, that sequence where they're taken into the house and there's your palace and it's the kitchen. And Jacqueline King goes, what do you mean that's us? Like, she's come from this middle-class house in Chiswick in London, and now she's stuck in Leeds in some grossy kitchen.
Boy. Yeah. And she gets to do a whole bunch of things in this story as well. I think more than anyone, you really, through Jacqueline King's performance, you really feel the despair of this world, because by the end of that episode, she's given up. She's completely lost it.
I think I don't think there's a more arrestingly directed scene than that one where the camera is right in her face and dominant, and there's just no emotion. She's utterly broken by the situation they've been put in.
And it's not just the situation, because, you know, that's been building. It's been building up for years and years, and it's a constant stream of how could it get any worse? And then you've got and it comes right after this, you know, this Italian immigrant family that they've come to love has been sent off to a refugee camp. And then at that point, it's just like,
is this the darkest episode of Doctor Who?
In
its implications of humanity in a crisis.
It's certainly in moments it's more Torchwood than Doctor Who, perhaps in the best way possible, I suspect, in terms of the quality of the writing. I'm not sure if it is the darkest story. I'm not sure I'm even interested in declaring what the darkest story of all time is, but I think it's certainly up there for sure.
I don't think it can be considered the darkest story, because there are great jokes in it as well.
Yes, that is true. That
when,
is true.
When they're singing the sea shanty, and then the fella walks aside, and Wilf's sitting there going, "Well, I always like to sing song." That's great.
Do you know, it's that bit where they get sent to Leeds. I saw that out. Someone said, you know, taken out of context, that scene is incredibly funny. It's just someone going, "You're going to Leeds," and then it's a cut to Cameron Tate looking really sad in a bus.
No, it's her impression of the Coronation Street character. What is it? Go back to pub and feed Whippet.
Oh yeah, I mean, you could show that to. I feel like that's that almost feels like a test to see if you can understand how English people talk,
Yeah,
because I don't
quite
think.
a bit of a struggle. Circling it back around to Sylvia for a second, what I really like is I think this episode goes a long way to humanizing her a lot, just because the situation she's in is so appalling. There's one sequence where they're all singing, right? Mamma mia, mamma mia. And
Oh
she's in the middle of that room, and she is so
she is, yeah.
uncomfortable because she's trying to join in, but this is so not her world on any level. And you just
Yeah.
sitting there trying to say the words and looking really awkward. Like this is not the sort of the dotage that she was promised. You know, she's a very middle class house. She's kind of well to do. She goes off with the
Yeah.
Friday girls, you know, and has a nice time drinking. And so this sort of despair, it wasn't factored in at all. But they never ever forget the, and I think this is so honest, that she finds Donna a massive disappointment. So when she's clearing out Donna's box from the office when Donna's been fired, she goes, "Yeah, to be honest with you, I've given up on you." And she just says it as an aside. And then that's repeated
Yeah.
in the later scene after all these terrible things have happened. And Donna goes, "I suppose I've always been a disappointment." And the only thing Sylvia can rouse herself to say is, "Yes."
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and he, I mean, it's even before then, even before you get to that line, which is just so, it's a killer of a scene. But it's also right before that line where, you know, the scene starts with Donna kind of going in, kind of saying, you know, the army, I went to apply for a secretary job at the army. They said I weren't qualified. Yours, she says something like, you know, I should have, yours said I should have tried harder in school. And it's, which, and she doesn't even bother to respond to that. She doesn't even, she barely has enough capacity to acknowledge Donna kind of being, so glum about that. And you know, you talk about Sylvia and that, you know, that shift in her class, in class status. Because you know, and Sylvia even says, you know, we can't even vote anymore, we're nothing.
Yeah.
It's that thing where Donna is talking with Wilf when he's looking at the telescope, and he and she says, you know, I always wanted to set aside a bit of money for you, so you could live comfortably. And now they've ended up in this situation where with where the, you know, they're making do, and they're making do with the people they have to hand, but it's not what any of them ever wanted, let alone planned for.
What Rusty Davis is very capable of doing, because he's a very naughty man, is making us fall in love with this family across a season, and then to put them in a situation so terrible, and then shove a camera right in their faces so we can see their reactions to all of it. You know, and I'm not sure there's another point. I know you said sort of with the alien invasion and all that. I'm not sure there's another point where the series of regulars, maybe with the Tylers, I'm not sure, where you could tell this story.
I think maybe not. I think that one's a bit harder to judge in some ways. I'm sure Russell could have worked out a way of doing it. Doing a version of Turn Left with any of his, you know, if it's the Joneses or the Tylers or the Nobles, but it would have been every version would have been different. I think, but with the premise, I think what's truly remarkable about it is that Russell, has built, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, Russell has built enough of a world, and a world that has its own continuity, you know, with the alien invasions, that that is filled with regular people, that he can do this episode, because you know, the Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi, Jodie Whittaker, even eras and the classic series don't really have enough of a grounded world of characters, of long running characters, to really do this kind of premise in exactly this kind of way.
And what I would also say as well is, and I do think, you know, they always cast the regulars well in the new series. This might be some of the strongest actors that we've got as well. So that factors into this. Jacqueline King, Catherine Tate, Bernard Cribbins. I mean, Bernard Cribbins, fuck's sake, that sequence where the fella gets dragged off to the what's going to be a concentration camp. Bernard Cribbins trying desperately to hold back the tears.
Yeah. Oh, it nearly made me cry. Very, very nearly. It's beautiful acting. The caliber of the actors that the show has at its disposal is just incredible. But the other thing you get, but also the part of what the whole episode is about, beyond setting up the series finale and getting Donna into position to getting Donna's arc into place and bring back Rose, it's also more broadly a meditation on what does the world look like, you know, as you say, the premise is what happens in a world where the Doctor isn't there. And I think it's part of why the premise works so well, because, you know, in the past in classic Doctor Who, I think especially, you know, you've had organizations like UNIT in the background and part of the world that you can, anytime the Doctor visits Earth, you can kind of go, oh, we can tap into UNIT or something. But in this kind of episode, which, you know, and this is not me ragging on it at all, certainly fills out its runtime with a lot of reused footage from the last
from the it's last like one of those years. American clip shows that they do.
Yeah, definitely. Russell has expanded the world enough, and it has enough people in that world who are capable of, you know, investigating that. It's not just one, you know, it's not just UNIT that is in charge of solving all these, you know, you've got the all these alien invasions in some shape or form. Some of the time are stopped, but, you know, you've got Martha Jones in the hospital who sacrifices her last canister of air. You've got Sarah Jane and her gang who die.
Sorting out the Sontars. But in your normal Doctor Who story, you'd be on the hospital, you'd be on the Sontaran spaceship. That's where the story would take place. This story is totally interested in the consequences of those stories, just in a very sort of raw, very intimate way.
Yeah. And it's that thing where part of the meditation of the episode is what does the world look like without the Doctor? And it kind of falls on the side of, there are certainly people who can do what the Doctor does, but they're, you know, people, and more vulnerable in a way that the Doctor isn't, and not as smarmy and as clever as he is. So you can, roughly speaking, get to the same outcome. You can stop the Sontarans, you can restore the atmosphere, but it comes at a much heavier toll.
The mileage he gets out of that moment where the newsreader says that Sarah Jane is dead. I remember when I first watched that and I was like, did he go there?
and it's not, is it her and the gang?
Are
the
and kids all the kids? Dead? Yeah.
Yeah, he kills them all.
Maybe Russell Davis was having a bad week that week. Kill them all. I'm sick to death of all these shows.
Come on, please. I just want to quit.
It serves as a wonderful trailer, doesn't it? Because obviously Torchwood and Sarah Jane Adventures are all part of the next story. So it's a reminder of all of those shows as well before we start to have some fun.
Yes, that's true. There's a nifty bit of signposting. But also, certainly not in the classic series. I'm not sure about in the new series. I'll go with this assertion for now and feel free to disagree. I don't think, because as I mentioned, you know, there is an aspect of this episode where it's one, you know, high concept episode, dark high concept episode, and there's another aspect of it which is it is a clip show of various things we've seen over the last 3 years.
I never feel that way though. This always feels
It doesn't. It's part of what I imagine Russell must have spent a lot of time working on to get right, which is, you know, he's clearly decided quite early on, I'm going to reference all these things that have happened in the last three series. And I think it's this thing that he got very right, where he was acknowledging he had the freedom to do that, to kind of go, Doctor Who is popular enough, it has a big enough audience that we can reference the hospital, the Jadoon episode, and not even show the Jadoon or Martha Jones, and people will still probably, there's a good chance they'll recognize that a hospital going up and down from the moon is that episode of Doctor Who. So it has that.
This has to come out once Doctor Who's in the zeitgeist and a lot of people recognize that imagery. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it did. The ratings were climbing this season.
Yeah. But the other thing as well is that for an episode that is built around a lot of internal continuity for the Russell T. Davis era, it doesn't feel inaccessible. Although you feel the impact of each individual invasion, it's not like all of a sudden we're gonna suddenly unpack how the atmosphere works after Torchwood blew up the Sun Tyrants. We're not unpacking that for 20 minutes. Because, you know, people, and it's that thing where, you know, the people on the ground aren't going to know that. The scientists are going to know how all these different invasions have affected the world. But for a person on the ground, you know, you're just getting shoved. You're just getting shoved to Leeds.
If you haven't seen it, you don't know why. As well, you know, it's almost like a teaser, or you want to see what happens when all these alien invasions were foiled. What? Go back and watch this one. Go back and watch The Runaway Bride, the Sun Tyrant Strategy, Smith and Jones. Do you know what I think is the closest parallel to the classic series to this?
What would that be?
I think it's Inferno. We're in a parallel universe. We get very close to those characters, as close to characters as I think we ever do in the classic series, because it's a 7-part. Uh-huh. And the end of the world is nigh. So there's a sort of intensity to it and a desperation. And yeah, I think that's, and interestingly enough, Inferno and Turn Left are considered to be two of the strongest of classic and New Who. So maybe we're all great fatalists at heart.
Yeah, maybe.
But also as well, I think this really shows Russell T. Davis the diversity in his writing, because we've just had Midnight, which effectively was set in one location with a small group of characters. And he got right to the nub and the drama and the human emotion within that situation. And then you come across the Turn Left and it's pulling in alien invasions left, right and center. And it's on such a scale. Like he can handle both with absolute aplomb. I think these two episodes back to back probably showcase the best of the work he did on Doctor Who.
Very hard to dispute that in many ways. You could probably say Midnight, Turn Left, The Stolen Earth, and Journey's End as four episodes.
Yeah,
do that just as well. But yeah, I think again one of the things that this episode does, and you know, it is worth acknowledging that the episode isn't entirely standalone. It is build it in its construction, it is building up to the finale. It's setting up a bunch of things and paying off a few things as it goes as well, as a lot of Russell's work tends to. But it is the third outing in that kind of Dr. Light genre that Russell himself started with Love and Monsters, and then you get Blink, and then you get Turn Left.
And I think they're all great, and they're just getting better.
That yes, yeah, they're all, and they're each very different. But I guess what you get in Turn Left, which you don't get in Blink and Love and Monsters so much, is that, you know, Love and Monsters, the scale of that is very small. It's tiny. It's really, really intimate. In fact, now that I think about it, there's a whiff of Turn Left in that story as well, you know, because, you know, you get them revisiting the Sycorax invasion in that story.
Yeah.
So there's a, I wouldn't be surprised if a germ of that, of Turn Left, came from that story.
Shop window dummies come to life.
Yeah. But Love and Monsters, very small in scale. Blink as well, you know, for all of its brilliance and genius, is also still quite a small story. Turn Left, the scale and the stakes of the story are as big as anything. Bigger
By the
than
end
anything.
Of the episode, the stars are going out. That's how epic this is. Oh, God, that scene, Jack. Just him saying, oh, my God, the stars are going out.
Yeah. It's proper. It's proper good.
There's one bit I absolutely loved where it showed just how sort of irrelevant they were in this situation, where Donna goes, but what is going on? There's nothing to fight. This is just it. And, you know, if disaster struck on planet Earth, that's kind of, we would all just sort of be swept along with it, you know? It's not like a Doctor Who story where there's a villain to defeat or monsters to suck into the void or whatever you're going to do. There's no way back from this.
Yeah, is this the bit where, you know, Rose is trying to assure Donna that she's important, and she goes, well, literally, what can I do? And she comes back, she says that a few times as well.
I'm glad you brought up Rose, because, you know, we've barely talked about Billy Piper yet.
I know, quite surprisingly, considering this is the episode she...
Extraordinary dental work.
Yes, I had heard that was a thing that happened between series 2 and 3.
I don't really notice it anymore. At the time, I thought it was very apparent. You know, I've heard people criticize her role in this and how it's like out of character for Rose.
I think I can see that, but for me, it's perfectly fine, because it's a continuation of, it's a progression of Jackie's concern in Army of Ghosts, where, you know, she has that little moment where she says, you know, that girl, that strange girl, on some planet 100 billion miles away, and I won't have a clue who she is. Rose has kind of become that at this point.
But in Army of Ghosts and Doomsday, she's shown as being remarkably competent. Like, their relationship is sort of fused. And then at the end of Doomsday, she says, doesn't she, oh, I'm working for Torchwood now. So I just believe she's a very smart, very capable woman that's seen and done all those things. And now she's striding universes to try and find the Doctor to stop Davros from destroying everything.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. That intention does come across. But there's a moment where, circling back to the point I was making, where it's when they're at the makeshift unit base with a rudimentary time machine. I love it when, you know, and I think you get this in Davis's work a lot. This is a quick tangent. When, you know, so many machines in the Davis eras are just cobbled out of junk and wires, and the act of using them, like, they explode, and it's like the physical strain of time travel from these scraps. But there's a bit where it's with Captain Magumbo, isn't it?
Marvelous, isn't she? I love her.
She's great. But Rose is saying some complicated science fictiony kind of line, and the captain says, "Yeah, she talks like that," which is kind of what the point Jackie was making in the first place, which is that you won't be talking like a person anymore. You'll just be some space woman talking nonsense. And Rose has kind of become that now. And I think the narrative kind of, you know, it's still Rose Tyler, and she, but it's not in a way. I think she, I mean, she's this kind of spectral figure who haunts the story. Like a ghost.
Like her visitations, aren't they? I mean, the whole thing is brilliantly directed. But I love the way she sort of pops in and out of scenes.
Yeah. It's really, really good. And there's some nice details in the visual storytelling. Because, you know, she's constantly popping out in these kind of like techno blue bolts of light. And it's that moment where Donna sees that flash of blue light, and she walks off in pursuit of it, even though Sylvia's going, the streets aren't safe anymore. And she can do that because she's seen that exact light, and it only means one thing. It's very, well, very nice.
And then we come to that point, don't we, where she just goes, I'm ready. She sees the light and she goes, I'm ready. Let's do this.
Yeah. But this is the thing. Although, you know, Rose Tyler is kind of treated like a ghost in this story in some respects, I feel like she also kind of, in a way, acts as the doctor in this story.
Yeah, for sure.
Like
someone's got to deliver that speech of how that time machine works, and yeah. I think the only option we've got is Rose.
Yeah, unfortunate. Sorry, Billy, you're all we've got. In you go.
But it's when Donna goes, it's a time machine. And then Rose goes, it's a time machine.
Yeah.
Love that moment between the two of them.
Oh, they get some wonderful moments at the end. Like when, you know, Donna for the does her third bigger on the inside thing. Because, you know, you get the first one with the runaway bride.
Doesn't, in an episode that's full of very potent imagery, isn't that shot inside the TARDIS where they've got like the steaming mugs and there's just no life? The TARDIS is dead. Again, something you can't do very often. But Graham Harper shoots this so well.
He does. He does a bang up job of it. But it's this lovely thing where, you know, you've seen Donna the first time around go doing her big what face in The Runaway Bride. And then in Partners in Crime, when the doctor starts teasingly going, the TARDIS, it's bigger on the inside, she goes, oh, I know all that. And then the third time you do that, she just goes, can I have a coffee?
The show, oh, you are kidding me. Or something like that when she walks in.
But with Rose, even though towards the end, she is very doctorly in the story, but it's a very kind of alien doctor as well. Like she lies to Rose.
Attached, isn't she? Like Rose was always very emotional, and I feel like whatever she's gone through since then, because she knows Donna's off to die.
Yeah.
And she's still having fun with her, you know, and laughing with her, knowing and jokes and things. And then when Donna says, you know, well, I'm not going to die, am I? They're better, you know. And then Rose just goes totally sort of blank faced, I'm sorry.
Yeah, which is something and particularly, you know, with her saying, I'm sorry, that's something we've seen the doctor do a lot in moments like these. And also the whole thing she does is like, no, in 3 weeks' time, where Donna goes, you know, I'm not going with you. And then Rose says, no, you're not going to go with me now. 3 weeks' time you are. That's very the doctor.
And also the bit where she goes, oh, you still got that raffle ticket? Use it.
Yeah.
That's very the doctor as well. That reminded me of Paul McGann in the TV movie.
Yeah, a little bit.
People's futures, you know? But what surprised me was I didn't mind. I thought she played it all really well, Billy Piper.
Yeah, I think it's quite well judged as well. I mean, as you say, it's very clear that we're getting a very different Rose. We're kind of getting this you know, because we don't know, in many respects, we don't know what's happened with Rose. We don't know anything that's happened with Rose since Doomsday. We don't actually know how much time has passed since Doomsday.
And you know what's refreshing? Is there's no Doctor in this. So she can't be sort of... The second the Doctor's back in Stolen Earth, she's there with her phone going, find me, Doctor. You know, or she's... Oh, they're all here. No, wait, I'm not here. And I was here first. And suddenly our old Rose is back because the Doctor's on the scene. But because he's not in this, she just gets to shine as sort of her own person.
Yeah. Another thing I really like is that... And I think it's very well done because, you know, I think it's easy to kind of go, in some respects, it's easy to go, she functionally is kind of the Doctor for this story, a kind of ghost of the Doctor. But one of the Doctor-ish things she gets to do is the kind of, you know, you're brilliant, you're human speech that the Doctor has given before. And, you know, that, and especially in Davis's hand, which is a celebration of the ordinary. But, I think what he does really well here is, you know, she has that moment where she goes, you know, the Doctor's world is better. He makes everybody who he touches in his life, he makes better. And so she is doing, Rose is doing this whole, you're the most important woman in creation, and you are important. And she knows that because she has also been through that. She was thought she was unimportant and nobody, and then traveled with the Doctor and now knows that she's more than what she thought she was. So she, it's not just her suddenly being the Doctor, it's her own experience informing, or it's her own travel with the Doctor informing her worldview.
And if there's ever, you know, as any moments where we're like, well, I ain't Rose anymore, there's little moments like the bit where Donna goes, you know, she says all the techno babble, and Donna goes, well, what does that mean? And Rose goes, I don't know, we just made it up.
Oh yeah. Is that when they're describing the beetle and it's like it's in a state of flux? Oh, I in a scene that is otherwise harrowing to watch, and the way they shoot the reflections of and the mirrors with the beetle, it's so well done. But I love that unexpected comedy of it's so funny when bitterly funny. But when it's that thing where they go, what is it? We don't know. And Don just goes, thanks.
Well, actually, talking about the comedy, the thing, and I think Rossi does this throughout his entire run, but it's refined here and it's used as a weapon in that he'll give you a moment of relief or a moment of triumph and then snatch it away from you. And he does it loads here. They have the sing song, and then suddenly you can hear the guns firing outside, you know?
Yeah.
Or I really love in that scene you were just talking about there, where Rose is laughing about how she's making it all up, and then suddenly Donna goes, you liar, like that. And it, the whole tone of the scene changes dramatically, instantly. It's so good, such good writing.
Yeah. It's got an edge to it.
He plays my emotions like a finely tuned instrument, Jack.
It's like Russell wrote those words himself.
He did say, when they did the read-through, Catherine Tate doing the, you know, I'm going to another world, a better world, the Doctor's world, in the read-through, everybody applauded after she did that. And he said it was like the best sort of offhand performance in a rehearsal, a read through of a script that he'd ever seen. And he just knew the episode was going to be amazing because Catherine Tate was there right at the heart of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm sure David Tennant must have had a great time if he was even there. just being able to bask in Catherine Tate's brilliance. But another thing, I don't think the episode draws too much attention to it, because it has so many other things on its mind. But it's certainly something we see Davis do later, is that we do get, when we travel back in time, and we see the turn, what if you turned right, when we start there, one of the things Catherine Tate has to do is do a little bit of a reset on Donna as well, because it's Donna before she traveled with the Doctor. And we don't spend too much time on that. And, you know, we see a lot more of back to pre-Runaway Bride Donna later in at the end of the Journey's End and in the End of Time. But we do see it here as well. And, you know, when the hospital goes up and down from the moon, she's just in her own world.
Isn't that wizard?
Which is very... It's what Donna would have... Exactly how Donna would have behaved prior to meeting the Doctor.
It's that same Donna from Journey's End that goes, yeah, all right, see ya.
Yeah, all right, see ya.
Or I like the line she gets at the beginning. H.C. Clements is in the city. It's nice. It's posh.
It's posh.
It.
Yeah. Because, you know... And because here's the thing, Sylvia is being a bit unpleasant. She's making a pretty valid point as well. But also, you know, when she's fired as the personal assistant, and she's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to be taking this to the tribunal, and you know, first thing I'm going to be saying, wandering hands.
Yeah. He gets away with a lot, Ross T. Davies, doesn't he? Because what does Sylvia say? Oh, they only want temps for practice.
Oh, yeah. They don't need temps for anything except practice.
Yeah, I mean, there's a world in that line, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. And you get, and the fun thing with that line is you get some two versions of it. You get the version where Donna goes, yeah, well, they haven't met me. And then you get the other version where Donna goes, yeah, you're right. That is kind of what they do.
And you know, like we've always, you know, sort of probably pre-sliding doors. Have you ever played that thought experiment? What if ... you had made
a decision on that? Surely we all have.
I think when we lose people and things like that, you know, you often play that, oh, you know, if only we got to the hospital quicker, if only we got that diagnosis done quicker, if only ... It's such an interesting idea. I like the fact that this is boiled down to something as simple as a turning on a road.
Yeah. It does make for the most undramatic final frame before going into the Doctor Who intro, which is just a car turning right. And then the music kicks in.
I know. It doesn't give you any clue of the drama that's to come, does it?
No. But a lot of it is that whole bit at the intersection, at the turning, is really well done. Because, you know, in the pre-credit teaser, we see that truck that Donna later steps out in front of.
It's so cleverly done, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all set up very neat.
Talking about that, I think my favourite sort of couple of minutes of New Who is the culmination of this plot where she goes back in time. First of all, I just adore the joke where she goes, hang on a minute, this is Sutton Court.
Sutton's Court.
I'm half a mile away.
And it does that big, and then it does that crash zoom out.
Well, and do you know what? Graham Harper's a clever sod. Because did you notice someone walks past with like a beatbox?
Yes.
And I think for a second we're like, oh shit, is she in the 80s? Where the hell was she landed?
Yeah.
But then it becomes a race against time. She's literally got, you know, a couple of minutes to stop herself from making that choice. Mm. And that leads to, I'm going to say that word again, one of the darkest endings, to where the companion has to choose to commit suicide in order to make that happen.
Yeah. And you know, Davis doesn't shy away from that. That is absolutely what it is. I think he tries to cushion it a little bit.
Well, the direction does, because they're not going to show us somebody being hit and blood going everywhere, and that's what it actually looked like.
Certainly not. But I think there is a little bit of cushioning done, just a little, when Donna is doing her, you know, a better world speech, the Doctor's world, where she does say, I'm not really dying, because this world will just blip out of existence. It's not really dying. So he's kind of framed it in those terms. So that softens the impact, I think, a little bit. But nonetheless, it is a striking moment where Donna Noble the only thing she can think of doing is saying please and stepping in front of a truck and killing herself.
I just think that that three punch hit of the comedy of her landing in the wrong place, followed by the excitement of her having to get there, and you're going, you know, run, 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 followed by the tragedy of her having, I mean, that is just amazing television.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. And the other thing, part of what makes that whole moment so, part of, I think, what lends it its power is, you know, the Trickster's Brigade, they're at the beginning in the pre-credit teaser, is constantly going, you know, when did you make that choice? When did you do this? When did you decide that? And in Donna's world, when Rose asks her that, Donna kind of goes, I don't know when that happened. And Rose acknowledges is that, you know, the choice that created this whole world happened in a moment that was so ordinary you would never even think of remembering it.
And you know what, Jack? We do this all the time. We make choices all the time that seem like totally random, unimportant choices. You never know what's going to be the important ones.
No. You drive yourself insane if you try to think like that. But it's what part of lends the ending its power, which is, you know, such an incredible sacrifice has been made by Donna. And it's for literally all it achieves is her just changing the indicator on her car and going in this different direction. That's all it's done.
And the reason why he's had her land so far away is purely for the, so she has to step in front of that truck.
Yeah, yeah.
To hold up the traffic so she can't turn in that direction.
Yeah.
I can imagine Rusty Davis writing this and it all clicking into place and him just getting so excited, like, my God, this world's a dream.
So do you think they deliberately dropped off Donna there? They put her at Sutton's court. They could always know exactly. Do you think they always knew?
I'm not sure if Rose and that did. No, I think Rusty Davis did because he knew.
Yeah, because he wrote it.
Because he's a bad man as well. But you know, in a story which has destroyed the entire population, you know, murdered the entirety of the population of London,
and quite a lot of America.
Tons of Americans, and completely broken the companion's mother. It then follows that up with the suicide of a companion. I mean, this is bleak.
Yeah.
It's as bleak as I can remember Doctor Who being. In a sort of a series of successive bleak moments.
I think it's very... Yeah, it's very, very bleak. Like, I don't know. The only other time I'm sure there have been other instances of it, but the only time I can think of a death, maybe in a similar kind of vein, is that moment at the end of Image of the Fendal where the Doctor helps with the suicide.
Yeah.
It gives him the gun. There's little in Doctor Who that is even remotely like this.
And I think, as we said, because these are such colourful characters, you know, and relatable, it means it isn't, because, you know, I've watched television that's very dark and bleak, and it can be a bit, you know, interminable to watch. This isn't at all. This is absolutely riveting, and in some parts really fun as well. You know, you've got the fella in the middle, what's the guy called who they live with? Oh, I kiss you too much. Mwah, mwah, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've got great fun. You've got Bernard Cribbins in there. You've got really fun characters. So it is a really enjoyable watch. Despite where it takes us.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still thinking about, because, you know, now that you put the thought in my head, because, you know, Rose says, you're going to die, and knows that, in order for the world to be restored, Donna has to die. So now I all I can think of is, could they have dropped Donna off exactly where they went and they were lying about how they had no control over the technology? Or
maybe.
Then
you'd
or was
have
it
to
just...
trust that she would make that decision.
That is true. That is true, which is a very callous calculation.
Oh, wow.
And
they're desperate.
But is it the Colasetano family? Is that what they're called? The Colasetano family?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Mama, she got the back room. You forgive, huh?
Yeah. She's old.
Oh, except for this one. Watch out for this one.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, I did. I think that, at first I was a little worried about that family in some respects because I think Davies possibly risks coming up with the most Italian of Italian families.
Bellissimo.
Yeah, I was like, and they're also joyous and we love to sing. But I think he humanizes them. He gives them enough depth that they don't just feel like a stereotyped Italian immigrant family.
Well, do you know what? Every time I'm thinking about, you know, the rug being pulled from underneath you emotionally, I keep thinking of another moment. The bit where he is saying to Donna, I kiss you too much, and it's all laughs and jokes, and then he turns to Wilf.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That whole tone and that scene. The moment you just said there about where Rose is sending Donna back, and she gets that wonderfully hopeful speech, and then Rose just says, I'm sorry. And the whole tone changes again. It's so clever.
I know. It's all these pivots, and it's just going back. It's so sad that he you know, he's putting on this big smile to kind of go, oh, you know, we're going to the concentration, we're going to the labor camps to do
It's
digging
for Donna's
and
sake, though,
sowing.
isn't it? That's why he's doing it. He's basically protecting her from feeling terrible.
Yeah. And but he also says that, you know, oh, new policy, you know, English, and he says English for the English. So he's introducing that kind of in a script that's already loaded to the gills with packed to the gills, mixing the metaphors there, sound like McCoy. Packed to the gills with a lot of very dark themes for a family television show, packing in a pretty big swipe at, English sort of nationalism and.
Well, that's something that years and years then takes and explores in a lot more.
Yes, absolutely.
Horrendous political party fronted by Emma Thompson.
That's right. That's
what are
right.
they called?
Yeah. You...
Britain First or something. Something like that.
It not. I don't think it's Britain First. It's it's. There was a number, in the party title, because she was always doing that. For something like four words or something. I can't remember, but it
she was compelling in that role, wasn't she?
Insidious. And yeah, I think you know. When it would never have fitted into the runtime, but we're not privy to, I think, because there's a mention of a emergency government that's formed, but we never find out anything about who's in charge and who's running, primarily because this is set from the point of view of Donna's family, and they're just being shoved wherever they can carve out a little living.
He's giving enough detail, though, to paint a very ugly picture.
Yeah. Oh, I have absolutely no doubt that in Russell's mind, someone like I think Emma Thompson's character in Years and Years was Vivian Rook, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. It was Vivian Rook because he took the name from Sound of Drums.
Yeah.
But I have no doubt when he wrote this, he was imagining a version of Vivian Rook being in power. Maybe not exactly that kind of character, maybe not that kind of Nigel Farage style character, but certainly someone in that vein, someone like the Prime Minister, like I think, is it Fairfax in Children of Earth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like to think that all of those details that we get, because the runtime's longer and years, that's all going on behind the scenes in Turn Left. So, you know, where they've got all the immigrants in those horrible little boxes and all of that terrible stuff is occurring behind the scenes in Turn Left.
Pretty much. I think it makes it, which is why I think you asked this earlier, could this be novelized as a not target book? I don't think it would, because I think there would be so many chapters where Russell would go to the point of view of these, you know, families who are suffering, if not from the effects of, you know, alien invasion, then from the effects of a empowered right-wing racist government.
Now, I almost feel like in The Sound of Drums, where he wiped out 10% of the population, and then we visit the Earth, and it is in a hell of a state, isn't it? You know, and people are living on scraps on streets that Martha goes to visit and things like that. But it's in no way as intense as anything we see in this episode. I think he wants to tell that story. Clearly he does, because he goes on to do years and years. And I don't think he went far enough in The Sound of Drums, but in order to tell this story, he had to do it as an alternative universe one.
Yeah.
Oh, and one that at the end, we've got a clean slate, right, we're back where we started.
I mean, yes. I don't think you could do, I'm not sure if you could get away or even want to do this story if it happened to
real
in the main world, you know, in the main universe. I think sectioning it away in a parallel universe is what makes it palatable to
the sort of the methods that we get to the planet falling apart is outrageous and science fiction, but the consequences and the reactions to everybody is very plausible.
Yes.
That's what sells this, is that, okay, those things aren't going to happen, but if there was a disaster, these things could happen.
Yes, and I think it's something the show likes to do later as well. I think Stephen Moffat tips his hat to this, maybe not in quite, definitely not in the same kind of detail or depth or darkness, but you know, in the Impossible, no, not the Impossible Astronaut, in Day of the Moon, you know, the Doctor asks Rory if he can remember any, what 2,000 years of being a plastic Roman soldier was like. And Rory kind of says, you know, it's all there in my mind, but it's like a door that's been closed. So Doctor Who, I think, certainly learns from Turn Left in that kind of going, just because it kind of didn't happen in a way doesn't mean it didn't happen. Emotionally, it still exists.
But there's a world of difference of covering it with a line and actually seeing all of this close up.
Yes. This is why I said Moffat tips his hat to this, right, as opposed to explore it in the way that Davies does. And certainly in the way, you know, Stephen Moffat characterizes it, it feels more like a neat way of addressing it in a line, and then it's like, oh yes, well, we dealt with Amy's trauma. We did it in two lines. We don't need to seriously explore that.
I'm resisting, because I was coming into this and I wanted to ask you, you know, why do I feel so much watching this one episode of Doctor Who where I don't feel as affected during the next era? But actually, I think for once I'm not going to ask that question, and I don't want to make unfair comparisons. But I did what I see. I watched The Snowmen the other day, and I was a little affected by the ending when buxom barmaid Clara dies. But then I watched this, and I'm like, okay,
you actually forgot the name of Clara, and it's like, oh, what's her name? The buxom barmaid. What was she called? Oh, Clara.
What, governor? You know that one.
Yeah.
But I was genuinely affected by it. But then I watched this the day after, and I was moved on a whole nother level. It's just different styles of writing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, Stephen Moffat would answer this one for you. He would say it's because Russell T. Davies is a genius.
He is. Yes.
It's kind of strange in a way, to think we've gone this long without. Actually, it's kind of appropriate in a way. We've spent so much of this episode alluding to the beetle on that hangs on the back of this story without ever really seeing it or addressing it.
Just to prove this is still an episode of Doctor Who, the special effects beetle is really shit. It's terrible. It looks like she's wearing a backpack.
I know. I think Graham Harper, I think the idea of this kind of like time form or whatever you want to call it that just feasts on alternative possibilities, it's a really potent idea. That one completely fired up my imagination when I was younger, of just this, you know, trickster cult of creatures that
I want
change the
to
course
sort
of
of
your
take
life
in
on
the
fun.
potential of possible timelines.
But I think a lot of it is saved by Graham Harper's direction, because it's you know, in that kind of way with it's the Jaws principle where, you know, you see the fin but you don't see the shark. It's, I think when you see, even though you certainly now you realize they're very cheap fake kind of beetle legs that are clawing onto her shoulders very
Terrible.
gently.
Yeah.
But I remember when I first saw that, and I was very young. I was young. I was definitely in the target demographic, and I thought the idea of this creature that kind of looked like a beetle, but you couldn't really see it, and you just get these spooky little glimpses of it, but you never really see it,
I think
very
at the
effective.
end, when she's in the mirrors, he shoots it brilliantly. Because you only get
Yes.
glimpses in mirrors and things like that, and it's just a little bit. And the thing that sells it is Catherine Tate's sheer horror at this thing that's
Yeah.
on her back, you know, how afraid she is. And that's something Doctor Who's been doing for donkey's years, way back into the classic series. If the special effects can't do it, well, a performance can, you know?
I mean, this is the thing. This is why the drama is harder in some respect, because you can send up a monster. It is harder to make a crap beetle into the most horrifying thing that you have ever seen.
I
And
actually
you
think,
know,
you know, the spider on Sarah Jane's back in Planet of the Spiders is more effective than that beetle.
I it's been a long time since I've watched Planet of the Spiders, so I wouldn't be able to say, but certainly this, all the stuff with the mirrors really elevates it. And some of the and as is the thing with Davies, when he does a lot of monsters, he likes to shroud them in something familiar, be them cats or beetles, but he also
Rhinos.
rhinos, yeah, but he also shrouds them in these kind of familiar terms that are also very, you know, strange and esoteric as well. Like, you know, throughout the episode, people are kind of going, it's like, you know, it's like I can see something, but it's invisible. And the whole staring at the and re reacting like there is the most horrible thing on her back
That
is
line,
very
it's
effective.
repeated three times, I think. There's something on your back. Oh, no, it's done in Farzad Pompeii to start off with, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what sets it up, and it's
That
paid off
shows you
here.
how much they are, yeah, sort of seeding some of this stuff in. But then I like the very over-the-top Spanish woman that works in the hotel just pointing at her from the distance like she's in Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
That woman is in a completely different movie. Completely.
Espalda, Espalda.
But also, it does, like, the first time it happens, it's quite effective. You know, you've got her friend when they're at the local pub, and all she's doing is staring at her back. And, you know, Donna even has that line when, you know, it's the Rachnos web star, and she goes, you know, there's a spaceship up there or something, and you're looking at me. And also it leads to some striking moments where, you know, the army soldier sees
That
and
bit.
And I also find
when drama gets hysterical like that, it's not really very effective. That bit's done brilliantly where he's got the gun on her and everyone's screaming, you know, put the gun down, what is going on?
And
there's an intensity to it that you don't often get in Doctor Who, I think.
The intention, the way, and the beetle is, and the way the beetle and the Trickster's Brigade work is kind of left, kind of, it's a bit vague in some respects. But I think the vagueness works to their advantage because we don't really know what the Trickster's Brigade is or what they want. You know, David Tennant turns up at the end and has a little kind of explanation, but it's not much. But it gives the episode a lot of breathing room for other things.
But it adds another layer to this, doesn't it? Because obviously the Trickster was introduced in the Sarah Jane Adventures. And then you have a Trickster story featuring David Tennant as well. The thing you said earlier about this sort of gloriously painted world that he's created around Doctor Who, goes branches off into all these spin-offs and things like that, where one series can sort of inform another. We'd never seen anything like this before, had we?
No. And it's fascinating that a lot of genre media, or genre TV, genre film, whatever you want to say, now they do this kind of stuff all the time. And I think Russell is very delighted to point that out.
I've got two questions for you. Because I think we've covered a lot there, you know. But I've got two questions to sort of out us from turn left. My first question is because basically we have said a ton of superlatives about this episode. And this is my favorite new series episode. You know that. I think I've said that on this podcast before. This is Mars Zenith. I know a lot of people say Heaven Sent, and I completely understand, and that's somewhere in my top five. But this, for me, I think I've come to a point now where how I'm emotionally affected by an episode of Doctor Who is as important to as sort of the plot, you know, and things like that. And this one just affects me deeply. But because we've said so many good things about it, is there anything in this that doesn't work for you? Is my question number one.
I don't know. I'd have to think on it some more. The only thing that really occurred to me was wondering if with the woman doing the fortune telling, I wasn't sure if that played into a bit of sort of orientalist kind of cliches there.
Oh, Jack, you're fascinating.
Which I understand. I'm sure in the context of the story, you can kind of make an argument for it being, it's an act that they're deliberately putting on and playing up to entice vulnerable, kind of absent-minded people. But I think, and you know, this was an episode of television made over 10 years ago, and there was a little part of me who's like, this is a bit, this is, I think we're resorting to some stereotyping here.
That's Chipo Chung, you know, Chan Tho herself.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I knew that, but had forgotten and spent my time going, where do I know her? I know that mouth.
I do think there's always going to be that danger that 10 years on, I mean, it's nearly 20 years, I think, possibly.
Yeah, probably closer to that.
But 10 years on, at least, looking back at anything, you know, things change a lot in a decade, don't they? So there is always that danger.
Yes. Oh, definitely, definitely.
And I think 20, 30, 40, 50, the further, the greater the number, the more in trouble you are.
Yes. I don't think it's particularly awful or anything. It was just something that occurred to me. I really do love that sequence at the beginning where they're just exploring this alien outer space marketplace.
Right. We need more of that, don't we? It reminds me of those scenes in Akatin, you know, where they're just hanging about the market.
Yeah, yeah. But you don't even really hear what they're talking about. They're not saying a bunch of nonsense words. They're just kind of like talking to people at storefronts. And, you know, I think Catherine Tate kind of leaves the Doctor with being excited about what looks like a tennis ball with or pufferfish kind of thing, and he's just delighted about that.
I love how they sell it with that establishing, that sort of elaborate special effects shot, which then just comes down onto the very normal street.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. The transition to that is not as seamless as they probably want. But it's still
years
nice.
Years in the last 10 years.
What did you think of the cliffhanger? Because it's an arresting cliffhanger.
That was my second question. Well, my second question was, is this the best lead into a finale or a two-part finale that we've ever had? Because I think this is well-gauged as well. The whole, she was a girl. She was blonde. She said two words. What were the words? What were the words? Bad wolf. And then suddenly it's just all furious, isn't it? And all bad wolf everywhere. The TARDIS closed the bells going. I love all of it. I think it's all brilliantly executed until he goes, it means the end of the universe, which is such a melodramatic line to go out on.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, you know, I think it's a great sequence. And certainly all the crazy zooms and cuts that it does of the letters and the words and the TARDIS as well. It's very gonzo. It's very big and very melodramatic.
But it's the sort of thing that really gets your heart going, don't you think?
It does, yeah. And I think it's earned it with the, because, you know, there has been this, Rose was such a popular character, and the stakes around her leaving were so big, and there were, I think, and the anticipation of her return was so immense that it already in this season it had been seeded a little bit, that it, I think they get away with the Doctor realizing she's back and making such a big cataclysmic event out of the return of the woman the Doctor loves. I think they get away with it. Even though I think in the next episode, it's not, I think there's a throwaway line about how that ending happened, why Bad Wolf suddenly turned up everywhere, but it's not really explained.
It's there for the cliffhanger. That's the only reason it's there.
Yeah, yeah. It looks good.
It looks great, especially on the TARDIS. I think they do this so well, and I think all of the showrunners do this really. I think Utopia had a brilliant cliffhanger that led into Sound of Drums. I think that Face the Raven had a brilliant cliffhanger that led into Heaven Sent and Hellbent. This sort of like the third to last episode of the season, when it is sort of a loose three-parter, they do this so well. I think it's great. I think it's really great. But the only thing that could possibly be more exciting, and I think it's the best trailer, the best Next Time trailer ever.
Oh,
it's when you've got Jack, Sarah, Rose, well, you know, Sylvia, Wilf, you know, one after another. I remember watching it going, my brain can't take it.
I know.
Best thing ever.
Yeah, and because everything's on streaming services now, you know, it does that little, skip the credits, little box comes up to go, next episode starting in 5 seconds. And I ignored it because I wanted to watch that little trailer. It was like, bum, 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 bum.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war.
It's really funny that they, at this point, look, I think, people, they had done special trailers with the Daleks in them at this point. And, you know, when there are only two episodes left in the series, you know the Daleks are coming back. But I think it's really funny. I think it's this, that they're, even in the teaser trailer, you're getting just little glimpses of them. And they're like, it can't be. You've got that Tennant going, oh, that's impossible. It can't be. And it's Daleks.
I just remember the sheer excitement of the thought of those three shows coming together.
Yeah.
This was Doctor Who doing, you know, Avengers Assemble before that was even an idea.
I know. A full what, 4 years before that ever happened.
And on 1/100th of the budget, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things that came out from the tweet alongs during lockdown. I think they did one for and from the writer's tale and from interviews that Davis has given, this was already well known. But when they were doing the tweet along, I think Davis talked at great length about how much bigger everything had been planned in his head. You know, there's that famous thing where, you know, the Shadow Proclamation was going to be
Oh,
every monster. But he also talked about a little bit about how, you know, for all that said about how Russell, you know, was winging it to a fair extent, for episode by episode, he talked a lot about how, oh, we knew we were going to do this for a while. Like, have you thought about those people's schedules that we had in those episodes? How much multi-year planning we had to do to make sure that that production block would line up, so we would have all the kids from all the cast of Sarah Jane, all the cast of Torchwood, all the previous cast of Doctor Who, that they were all available.
It must have been an absolute fucking nightmare. But you know,
Yeah, I
if
think.
he hasn't got the money to pull off the set piece, and I know we're talking about the Stolen Earth now, but if he hasn't got the money to pull off the set pieces, and I know there's that wonderful sequence where the Daleks are flying in towards the Valiant and destroy, and you know, there's a few glimpses of how this would have looked as a Hollywood blockbuster. It has scale because it dares to bring in this entire universe. But I think it has scale because of the energy that Graham Harper gives it throughout. Like, it is relentless, that episode.
God, what a run he had.
Oh man, oh man. He hasn't even done Waters of Mars yet. And his little tip to comedy with the Unicorn and the Wasp.
Oh yeah, I forgot he did that.
Oh,
God, what a versatile director.
I would probably go as far to say, though, like, I don't think this is his most well-remembered episode. I think that's still Doomsday. But I think this is a fucking nightmare to put together, this episode. Like, all those pieces, the sweep of the story, the emotion you have to get working with all those actors. I think this is probably the best direction he ever gave us.
Maybe. I'm sure there'd be many people who would maybe argue that point, but I think it's impossible to deny that the direction is so dynamic in this story. There's a as with anything directed by Graham Harper, there's a lot going on. It's as with the story itself, it's just wonderful. I'm not sure I could ever rewatch this. I could rewatch this frequently for pleasure. But
See,
I
I
do think it's
do. What
that
does
level.
that say about me? I think I watch this one more than a lot of others.
At least once a week, just to ring and
Not
restore your
that
faith in
bad.
humanity.
No, but certainly every sort of half year or so, I put this one on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in terms of sort of summing it up then, in terms of intensity, in terms of using continuity as a weapon, and boy does he, in terms of character drama. In terms of taking a really simple idea and exploring it in a complex way, and in terms of leading up to the finale, you know, maybe you can point out a few rare sort of problems with this. I think it's pretty peerless. Turn left.
As I said, I'm not going to be the one to necessarily dispute that. I personally, I think I'm not sure it's my favorite thing that Davies has written.
What is?
I don't actually know. I don't, but I don't think it's Turn Left.
Are you talking about Doctor Who now or as a whole?
Doctor Who.
Oh, I was going to say, because as a whole, there are things he's written that I think are better than.
Oh, if I'm sure, I as great as Turn Left is, I'm not sure I would say it's necessarily better than It's a Sin.
It's a sin, or that fabulous English scandal that we watched.
A very English Scandal, which is also
Woof.
terrific.
Yeah.
Or Nolly, or
Oh my god!
Is it Nolly?
Wonderful. Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I still need to finish. I watched the first episode and loved it, but wasn't able to finish the. I didn't get around to the second two episodes.
But you know, like, this couldn't be better timed, could it? Really, I was doing this now. Davey's at his peak during RTD1, when, you know, the heavens descend. He's here back for RTD2, and if he brings half of this with him, the show's going to be in great shape.
I'm sure it will be. We get David Tennant for 3 episodes and Catherine Tate for 3 episodes, and then we get all this other wonderful, exciting stuff.
I keep seeing in these sort of trailers they keep putting in, these redacted trailers.
Oh, yeah.
These brief glimpses of imagery, which look amazing. All the cards going in the air, or him blowing out the rose petals and things like this.
Yeah, we haven't had those in a very long time, because they did a few for the 50th. Of Matt Smith interrupting those BBC Idens. And they did a few for Capaldi in his first series as well, in the lead up to Deep Breath. There are all these little scratchy teasers of him in the TARDIS with psychic paper, or the TARDIS exploding around him. It's an exciting time to be a Doctor Who fan, that's for sure.
It is. Well, then, you know, I've just summed up my thoughts. Do you want to, would you dare to give a brief summary on Turn Left?
I can have a go at it. Turn Left, I think, is, you know, aside from the significance of it as a, in relation to later things that Russell T. Davis writes, I think it's just a wonderful example of the way he looks at the world and the way he responds to the world. I think you see a lot of his anger and a lot of his frustration and his fury at the way our world works in it. But I think you also see a lot of his joy and his hope and his optimism in there as well. I don't think he wants to balance it. I don't think he wants to try and make it an even balance. It's as much of an expression of what Davis thinks of the world as anything. And it's all in a Doctor Who episode, of all places. I think the performances generally across the board, but especially from the series regulars, is truly outstanding. They all shine in different ways. You know, Bernard Cribbins is always going to sparkle no matter what you ask him to do, be it comedy or drama. Catherine Tate, it gives a thermonuclear performance that it just, you know, is one of the it's one of those episodes where you say, actually, we don't need David Tennant, we have Catherine Tate. But I do think a real shout out does need to go to Jacqueline King, who gives, I think it's probably my favorite performance from her. And it's not because her performance has ever been bad, or Sylvia is written any differently than she has been anywhere else in the series. But I think we just go on such a journey with her that it's worth it for her story, for her response to the impending calamity of the world. And I also think Davis does the whole what if premise in a really interesting way. I think the premise is in for Doctor Who, I think it's perhaps unique for this time, but it's unique. It may be not unique for this time. I'm sure if you could attempt a version of Turn Left in the Stephen Moffat years or the Chris Chibnall years, I think you could attempt a version of it, but I don't think you could attempt it with this kind of strength in behind the sails. I think it's also wonderful, like so many other people.
I'm not sure how we could possibly wax lyrical anymore about that particular story. The only response I can have to that is to take your hand and walk you to 15th century Mexico. Also, once we've been there, we'll pop across to 1960s America.
15, Oh, I see.
Jesus Christ. I was waiting for the penny to drop.
Yeah, I was like, what are we
Where we'll
talking
be
about?
taking a look at two very different stories from this, the Aztecs and Rosa, one from the very first season and one from one of the latest seasons, to compare and contrast the historical genre in Doctor Who.
Yeah. I think I proposed this one, so it's really bad that I didn't pick up on it.
That's right. So you've got to do some work this time. Come on.
Oh, fine. You work me hard, Joe Ford.
The thing is, though, is they're both very strong stories, I think, as well. It shouldn't be a hardship watching those two.
No. It's been very long since I watched either of them. Longer, I think it might have been 10 years since I've watched the Aztecs. So very excited, but I have the special edition, so I'm very keen to get my teeth into that one.
Weirdest thing watching them back to back will be going from a story that is attempting to realize, something quite epic. And then a series that can absolutely realize its historical setting, beautifully. Like the artifice of the Aztecs and the reality of Rosa. I'd be really interested just to see the productions back to back.
Yeah. 2018 versus 1963. Let's see who wins.
Honestly, there won't be any difference at all. But because you have to go to bed at some point tonight.
Yeah, and go to work the next day. For shame.
Well, come on in. Let's do this. Our
All
cult
right.
members out there are waiting to join in.
Yes, that's right. That's right. On three, we say probe the zero blank, and then you can fill it in with whatever you want. But aside from that, you can do that in your own time. In the meantime, we say 3, 2, 1, the Nymon be
Yo, yo,
praised.
yo, the Nymon be praised. Oh no, sorry. I got
Wow, we're really trying to get every possible variation, aren't we?
that wrong. okay, go on then. I'll do another one. Come on. One more time.
We're doing it again. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry. 1, 2, 3. The Nymon be
Nymon
praised.
be praised. How's that?
Wow, you really sounded like an Italian family there.